You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of November 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
The ongoing onslaught of populist demagoguery across the Western world, where will it end? My guests Tom Edwards, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including visa-free travel for Ukraine. Does it really have anything to do with Eurovision? Plus, would you buy a detective novel from Dilma Rousseff? And
look for the price. Only 99p for four dairy ice cream cones. That's why Mum's gone to Iceland.
Iceland takes on Iceland. Can a country get too protective of its national brand? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Monocle 24's executive editor Tom Edwards, Henry Rhys Sheridan, producer of Monocle 24's Section D, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, executive researcher or senior researcher or something like that, and senior Eurovision correspondent here at Monocle 24. Welcome all. We are going to start tonight with an inversion of the conventional wisdom, which holds that where the US leads, Europe follows. Because over the last few years, we have seen significant swaths of Europe and its immediate neighbourhood fall beneath the thrall of belligerent strongmen and or seduced by populist chimerae and or vastly overinflating the threat of terrorism and or becoming consumed by paranoia about migrants and refugees. Whereas earlier this month we saw the US tick the all of the above box and elect Donald Trump president. Tom, first of all, is there a pattern here, or is this just a bunch of stuff happening independently of each other?
Well, worryingly, it seems to be a little of both, which makes sense, I think, if you look at, you know, what we've seen in Europe, which is where you're seeing a general response to a political class that's perceived to be out of touch, that's perceived to not care about the people who are being left behind. And that is the same as the US. I think it's cause and effect. I don't think this exactly the same kind of political characters are rising to the top, but we are seeing people cashing in on this notion of the anti-elite, the anti-establishment. Now, the joke here is, of course, that Trump is a 70-year-old white American billionaire, much like Farage, the self-styled anti-establishment
who
character
lives
in this country.
A penthouse apartment in New York, which he reaches in a gold-plated lift.
Exactly. So it's all about perceptions. Now, the worry is that I think it's not an inversion from what you said at the beginning. I think it is the conventional wisdom that where the US leads, Europe follows. And we'll put that to the test, won't we? In France next year, in a roundabout kind of way, in the Italian referendum.
In the Netherlands.
In the Netherlands, certainly. Let's hope not, at the German ballot boxes next year as well. So, you know, will it get worse before it gets better? My worry now is that it will.
Henry, to extend that happy thought, the history books teach us that Europe going in for populist, nativist demagogues tends to end messily. Where do you think this is heading?
Well, I think that I've got an idea, Andrew, about what needs to happen to stop it getting to the worst case scenario, which is, I remember the day after Brexit. Well, no, it wasn't the day after. It was the first gathering of the European Parliament after Brexit, and Farage was there. And, you know, there was obviously a lot of jeering on the floor, as you may imagine. But there was this one moment, this kind of remarkably human moment, where Farage stood up and gave a speech in which he said, I entered this chamber 17 years ago wanting to lead a movement that would see Britain leave the European Union. You laughed at me then, you're not laughing now. And I think, looking at Farage, looking at Trump, one of the remarkable aspects of these linked phenomena is you do have these individual figures galvanizing movements that have brought down huge institutions, be that, you know, the EU, or we haven't been brought down yet, but certainly, you know, Brexit was a big cut. You've got the Democratic and Republican Party machines in the US. And it makes me wonder, do these large institutions, be it the EU or, you know, now the Democratic machine in the US. Is there some more kind of Weberian charismatic leadership, which is kind of equivalent to what the right has with these figures, needed on the part of progressive movements? You know, does there need to be a more galvanizing personality? I mean, with all due respect to the likes of, you know, Schultz, Juncker, they're not going to get anyone's blood rushing anytime soon, are they? So, you know, I know that's kind of a dangerous turf to tread on, but I certainly have been thinking that recently.
Fernando, is this what happened in South America, which, of course, had a long period of being governed by bellicose strongmen who were then supplanted by, in many respects, what Henry's suggesting, the populist equivalents of the left?
Absolutely. And it's interesting, Andrew, what I see what's happening in Europe and the US as well. I see some parallels happening in Latin America at the moment. Because, you know, we did had more recently like a wave of very moderate, you know, center-left leaders. Of course, I'm not talking about Venezuela. But, you know, in Argentina, you know, in Peru, Brazil, other countries, which were actually, most of them, quite corrupt. And people were very disappointed with them. So there is a trend of people becoming, going back to the right. And we see the rise of very, very, very right-wing people, including Brazil, which I predict we're going to have a far-right candidate in 2018, which might do very well and could even go to the second round. I don't see it winning, but you never know these days.
Tom, what do you think? Are we now set on one of those courses of historical inevitability in which it will reach some sort of endpoint and events will just have to play themselves out, or can things be reversed?
I think they can be reversed. There's several things to remember. We have been in periods like this historically. Now, yeah, sure, there was a Great Depression in the late 1920s, and that presaged a shift to populism. We know how that ended. It doesn't follow that this time around, even though we had a mini crash of the same sort in 2008, that, you know, a global war is the consequence. To pick up on that point about the lack of charismatic leadership, I do think it's an opportunity for people to reappraise what's really important. There was a complacency, certainly in the US, about values that I think people took for granted, almost values that they considered sacrosanct in the US, whether that's, you know, women's rights or equality for different races or equality for people of different sexual orientation. And I think what we've seen with Trump's success is a questioning of the protection of those values. Are they sacrosanct? Are they as safe as we thought they were? The same thing happened in this country, I think, off the back of Brexit. I think we all thought we were broadly progressive. We all felt that we were broadly moving in the right direction. And if all of these challenges do anything, maybe they'll force people to restate their commitment to some of those important values. And I actually think we could see a response from that, whether that is galvanized by an individual with charisma, as Henry was suggesting, who's maybe coming from the left or the center left. Let's hope so. But maybe if it encourages everybody to say, well, hang on, these are actually things that are really important, and I must no longer take them, or we must not all take them for granted, that could be no bad thing, and maybe that lights the way out of this.
Yeah, I think also in terms of, you know, drawing historical analogies, obviously you've always kind of got to be careful, but, you know, I agree with Tom that one good thing that could come out of this is a reinvigoration and re-engagement, I think, on the part of people who are of a progressive mindset. Now, I'm a small C conservative in the sense that I think one lesson you can draw from history is that humans are basically made of the same crooked timber at any given point in history. But, you know, technologies and contexts are always different. And I think one thing that's remarkable about the slide to the right this time round, which compared to other, you know, slides to the right in European history previously, is it has been precisely fueled by, you know, the newest, paradoxically most kind of progressive technologies, social media being a culprit, which is often pointed at. Now, will the availability of these technologies and, you know, the way that, you know, the internet has transformed the world change the dynamics of, you know, this kind of slide towards a particular end of the spectrum of the human personality in a way? Probably, but I'm uniquely unqualified to comment on how that will be.
Good to have you with us on that basis.
Thanks, Dom.
Well, on that that humble note, we should move on, although at the risk of further inflaming pull-up-the-drawbridge nativism across Europe. The announcement by the European Council President Donald Tusk, this is, that citizens of Ukraine will be permitted visa-free travel for up to 90 days to Schengen countries, as well as Switzerland and Iceland. It was, of course, Ukraine's attempt to get closer to the EU that prompted Russia's intervention in 2014. Fernando, first of all, as Monocle 24's senior Eurovision correspondent, there is an aspect of this story which we must put to you, which is the suggestion that this liberalisation of visa laws and Ukraine's imminent hosting of the Eurovision Song Contest are in some way related. What are your sources telling you?
Well, my sources are saying that this could be one of the reasons. I mean, for sure. I mean, especially, the winning song this year, of course, was the Ukrainian song by Jamala, which was a very political song against Russia, which was...
It was also terrible.
It was mildly terrible, I would say, you know. the song is about ethnic cleansing of the Crimean Tatars under the hands of the Russians. So it's a very much anti-Russia song. And I think in this way, Europe is trying to get, Ukraine under its, under its arms in a way. So I think it was a good move as well. And, come on, it's just 90 days, I guess, without a visa, right? That's the proposal.
But Tom, is this, and there is some suggestion that Germany and France would much rather see this new law punted until past their elections. Is this basically a present to exactly the forces we were talking about earlier?
I'm not so sure. I mean, I think what's interesting, as Fernando alluded to, we've championed the Eurovision Song Contest as this, soft power mechanism.
Over my voluble objections.
Well, quite. You've made them clear. I may even agree with you to an extent. But it is interesting that a soft power vehicle can be commandeered by an explicitly political message, as it was last time, and then it has another knock-on effect. Now, if that was one of the motivating factors in opening up this this border or this ability to move freely, I think that's no bad thing. That song, I believe, was sure to have irked Vladimir Putin and Moscow more broadly. I think this move is calculated quite deliberately to do that. And so whilst, there's probably some leaders in Western Europe who would think, probably be best to kick this into the long grass until, say, next summer, I think they'll also see some merit to trying a little bit of the kind of... It's a bit of the Putin psychology. It's a bit of a soft power play. It's a bit of kind of diplomatic nose tweaking. I don't think they'll be too sorry to try this at this time.
There's even some chatter, actually, that Russia might boycott next year's Eurovision. I mean, we don't know. Nothing's confirmed yet. But, it could potentially happen, depending on who Ukraine selects as their... candidate. I'm not sure if they're going to choose another political song.
Oh, they have to, don't they? It would be hilarious. But then what would be even funnier is if then Russia then chooses something else equally explicitly belligerent.
Maybe with a military theme. I mean, idea about the Russian sort of delegation rolling into Kiev is pregnant.
These are the only things that I ever enjoy about Eurovision is the political subtext. My favourite one ever, in 1982, when I believe I'm right in saying it was held in the United Kingdom while Britain was at war with Argentina, Spain sent a tango.
Amazing.
What's not to enjoy about that all these years later?
Do you remember 2009's Georgia's entry, which they almost managed to go to the final, which was the song was called We Don't Wanna Put In. Of course, it was a joke with Putin.
You see, but then, what they've done there.
At a very last minute, the EBU, they said, okay, you can't actually perform the song live because it's very political. But they just decided after the CD was released, after the semi-finals, was very last minute.
Is the EBU like the IOC, but for the Eurovision contest?
Exactly.
I didn't realize it. I love the fact that there's a governing body.
Yes. Of course.
What do they do all year? I realise we are straying from the point somewhat here, but I'm fascinated by that.
Guys, Bulgaria is just about to host the Junior Eurovision in December as well. So, there's plenty of events the whole year round.
They keep themselves busy, Andrew.
Yes.
What do you mean there's plenty of events the whole year round? There's one. There's a Junior Eurovision, apparently, which I'd never heard of until this moment. And there's the actual one.
Semi-finals, research, where are they going to host in Kiev, the event?
You can knock all that off in a week.
Well, I think you need some research.
Really? That sounds like nice work if you can get it. Does it pay?
Of course.
Probably handsomely.
Probably lavishly, I was just about to say. And the ticket prices are not to be sniffed at,
A good destination for Nigel Farage may be up next.
And I'm sure the big five are paying, including the UK, actually.
Has Andrew just loaded up a CV on his match?
I know. I shall be polishing the CV up as soon as we're off air.
Well, Australia, of course, now active participants.
Well, indeed.
Exactly. Which I know you're very,
which I'm very
broadly
excited,
very excited
and
about.
It's more than I can say for Brazil, Fernando. So my qualifications... outstrip yours by some margin.
But it's just
maybe
been confirmed.
I should be senior Eurovision correspondent.
I think so. You know, it's just been confirmed that Australia is going to be there in Eurovision again next year.
Was it ever contested?
It's contested. I think every year people are a bit insecure about the fact, but I think, you know, now it's going to be a stable. It's going to be every year.
Andrew Miller's one-man crusade dashed.
I know. You realise we are now literally the only media organisation in the world talking about the Eurovision Song Contest, 5 months before it actually happens?
It fills me with a bizarre sense of pride for some reason. I'm not particularly interested in it personally.
Any early favourites, Fernando?
Well, we don't know the candidates, but who knows? Maybe Russia could win in Ukraine. That'll be controversial.
That would be amazing. We should actually return to there is a slightly more serious story here, which is the potential repercussions of what Europe is proposing to do here. Tom, as you were saying, this will irk Russia, which is possibly the reason that the European Commission is doing it. Will Russia therefore be obliged to express its irkness?
Well, generally speaking, Putin's not shy about so doing. I mean, I guess, you know, the other more worrying thing about this more broadly is that it prompts once again a discussion about EU border controls. It prompts, I'm sure it's likely to prompt further discussion in some of these countries that have high-profile elections, referenda and so forth ahead, about, you know, the nature, the meaning of their relationship. And I think any issues around the Schengen area or the free movement of people, rightly or wrongly, spark the kinds of discussion that we saw here in the UK prior to June 23rd. And, you know, it's impossible to have these kind of conversations without looking ahead to, for example, the French presidential election, and consider, you know, what would happen if, you know, in the worst case scenario, Marine Le Pen were not just to be a challenger, but were to win. You know, we've already seen countries that have suggested they'll be agitating for referendums of their own on EU membership, on the Schengen area, how it functions. You know, it's genuinely possible that we could have, you know, a key European country following suit and having a referendum on, you know, on an in-out membership of the Union in the next couple of years. What would happen if a country, I don't know, could France hold such a referendum? It would have been quite unthinkable ever since the European project began. It's still pretty unlikely, but it's not unthinkable anymore.
I also just want to point out here that it's become impossible to read these decisions made by the EU without considering the kind of wider geopolitical consequences and intentions on the part of the parties at hand. But, you know, the reason that Ukraine is being afforded this free travel, this visa-free travel, is the fact that, quite straightforwardly, conditions were set for them to be able to get it, and they met those conditions. You know, again, with Turkey, conditions have been set for their membership of the EU that aren't being met by Turkey. So I think that it's important to remind ourselves that this is also, on one level, just the EU being a kind of boring, process-oriented institution, which we know and love.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Tom Edwards, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up next, Iceland versus Iceland. Whose side are you on?
Monocle invites you to raise a glass of Glühwein at the annual Monocle Christmas Market. Please join us for this winter wonderland of a weekend, complete with warming treats from the Monocle Cafe, reindeer petting and an appearance from Monochan the Owl, all set to a cheery playlist. You can also try your hand at our ever-popular tombola and meet our VIP Santa Claus all the way from Rovaniemi. The 2016 Monocle Christmas Market on Saturday the 3rd and Sunday the 4th of December from 11 a.m. to 1700 at our Midori House HQ here in Marylebone. Find all the details at monocle.com. We ho ho, hope to see you there.
Yes, You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Tom Edwards, Henry Rhys Sheridan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And let us look now at Iceland, which has launched legal action against the British supermarket chain of the same name. The former claims that the latter impedes its efforts to properly promote Icelandic produce abroad. The coincidence of names aside, however, it is difficult to imagine that anybody would ever confuse the pair. One is a strange, freezing, forbidding landscape largely populated by daylight-starved troglodytes foraging for bizarre culinary ingredients, while the other is an island in the North Atlantic. Tom?
Well played, Andy.
Thank
well
you. I worked on that for some time. Does the existence of Iceland the supermarket in any way inform your opinion of Iceland the country?
Whenever I see stories like this, and I'll bracket it in with some of those frothier, more kind of light-hearted political stories that we sometimes cover, I just think they must have some more important business to be focusing on. Let's not forget, we were talking earlier about the 2008 crash and so on.
I've been to Iceland a few times. I'm not sure they do, to be honest.
This is the only country that, you know, had to replace a senior member of the government as a result of the Panama Papers. They had crises, two, three times over between 2008 and the sort of putative recovery. I would imagine that many people in Iceland, the country, not the chain of...
I'm glad you made
the frozen food retailer, would be pretty irked to imagine that they're expending any more of that precious political or literal capital on pursuing this claim. I think it smacks of a bit of humourlessness. I think it's disappointing. However, it is also quite entertaining, so I'm conflicted about it.
Henry, is there an element of snobbery here? If Iceland had been, the country that is, had been conquered many years ago by people who for some reason decided to call it Waitrose, and there was a subsequent coincidence of supermarket names, do you think they'd be getting as upset?
We should stipulate for our listeners that Waitrose is a relatively more upmarket supermarket chain in Britain compared to Iceland, which is slightly lower down the scale, just so they can fully understand that. I'm just trying to imagine a country called Waitrose now, and kind of what it would...
Can I just say, I volunteered to be citizen number one.
Of course you would. No, I mean, what I'm most excited about...
You live in Walthamstow, Tom, which is pretty much the same thing.
It's ballpark. You know, I just hope that the actual court case, if it is brought forward, is Iceland versus Iceland, because it would be of the form of my favourite variety of court case, which is when it's an individual, a named individual or party against a nation state. You know, this is most often the case in the USA, of course. You know, Loving versus the USA being the case that brought down the ban against mixed-race marriage, which was an absolutely fantastic historical coincidence. Brown versus Board of Education. It's just a lovely sentence, isn't it? Well, it's not even a sentence kind of phrase. So Iceland versus Iceland. I want to see the legal documents which pertain to this case and potentially photocopy them.
I might defend the supermarkets here because I don't see a problem. You know, I'm a Brazilian man, never cared about Brazil nuts. I don't mind them, you know, being promoted all over.
I'm not sure if that's a...
So,
well, you make a fair point, because any country in the world, pretty much, if it could be bothered, could spend its entire life suing people or threatening to sue people for using the name of their country as a product.
I mean, is it embarrassing that this grievance, which has been brought forward by the country of Iceland, essentially reduces a country to basically the equivalent clout of a downmarket British supermarket? That is a bit humiliating, isn't
it? That could
it?
Be one of the inadvertent consequences.
It's not good for your soft power.
Well, no, the official line from Icelandic officials is that the government of Iceland, I am quoting here, is concerned that our country's businesses are unable to promote themselves across Europe in association with their place of origin, a place of which we are rightly proud and enjoys a very positive national branding. Are we buying that, Tom? What is Iceland's national brand, anyway?
Well, and if it's that robust and positive, then you surely wouldn't worry about a supermarket chain in another, still for now, EU member state. I think, you know, governments and countries need to have more confidence in expressing what their brand represents. And I think the more that you have legal cases of this type, it often strikes me when there's a very aggressive rebrand of a country or region that I have similar reservations. People should be more confident about what they represent. Alternatively, you know, put their own house in order. I don't want to go back to what I said at the beginning, but I cannot believe, I don't know which department of the Icelandic jurisdiction this emerged from, foreign affairs or whatever, they must have something more to worry about.
I mean, judging from that statement which you just read out, it strikes me that this has probably stemmed from genuine misunderstandings in actual boardrooms, which, you know, it's difficult to imagine again, but I'm flabbergasted that the Iceland, the supermarket, has managed to extend its influence beyond Britain's borders. Frankly, I think that's impressive. Well,
so it has been going since the 1960s, perhaps?
Well,
one would have thought that this coincidence might have risen to somebody's attention.
Well, I for one hope that Iceland, the supermarket, invokes the fine British legal precedent of Arkell v. Prestram, which I encourage listeners to look up. And finally tonight, we shall contemplate the retirement plans of former Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff, removed from office by her country's Senate last month over accusations of fiddling the national budget. According to local reports, Rousseff plans to graduate from cooking books to writing them. However, she will not yet be setting about the score-settling memoir, traditional in such circumstances, but a detective novel. Fernando, will all the villains be thinly veiled representations of her political enemies? That would surely be the only reason to do this, basically. But, you know, when they yanked the mask off the janitor at the end and reveals that it was Michel Temer all along.
Of course, the main villain will be Michel Temer if Dilma writes a book. And I even have a name for him, the interim, because I think that's how the left says, because, you know, when you're interim president, when you're in between, you know, you're not really elected. So that could be a good name for a villain as well. So, and I have to say, if she does write a detective novel, which I hope she does, I'll probably buy it.
But you were telling us earlier that President Temer, or interim, as he's apparently going to be known, has a literary flair of his own, or so he prefers to think.
He does. He always wrote, I mean, even though he's 75, he always wrote poems his whole life. But he first released his first poetry book in 2013. It's called Anonymous Intimacy. And some of them were quite steamy, I have to say. Suggestive, may I say. I even have a few lines, if you may.
Please.
It's called Red, and it was written for his wife, apparently. And I'm going to read just, you know, a few lines. In red, flaming, fire flames, bright eyes, that smile with red lips, fires, they take care of me, my mind, my soul, all mine, they consume my body. Finally, remain ashes, I spread on the bed.
Lucky Mrs. Temer.
I'm glad he's only running the country and not doing anything literary.
I have to say, the critics haven't been positive.
Well, the incoming president of the United States is himself a published author of nonfiction, though I think it's entirely possible that he has written more books than he's read. Are there any literary works by politicians any of us have actually enjoyed?
I have actually got a list.
A list?
Yeah, I have. Valka Faval of the Czech Republic. You must be familiar with his work.
Indeed.
Winston Churchill won the Nobel Prize for Literature
yes, he
in
did.
1953.
Yes, I was going to throw Churchill in there because
it's a good pub quiz staple, that one, when you ask them what Nobel Prize Churchill won. No one ever gets
everyone
literature.
Everyone lots of peace, don't they?
An astonishing piece of work, History of the English Speaking People.
It is.
You know, he was no bad painter either. Maybe not a prize winner, but this was a guy who could turn his hand seemingly almost to anything. More than happy when you get a genuine Winston-esque polymath to read the fruits of their mind. I don't want to know what's going on in Donald Trump's head at the best of times.
Barack Obama's pre-presidency books were very good, and I'm sure the post-presidency one will be as well. Ulysses S. Grant's memoir is a ripper.
Benjamin Disraeli's light entertainment novels. I'm sure you're familiar with them, Andrew. No?
I have not yet attempted those. Are they worth it?
Yeah, I'd dip in there. I think dip your toe in there, and you know you can always put it down if you get bored halfway through. But I like that model of the statesman. You know what I mean? The idea of kind of ending the day by bashing out a few pages.
Ian Duncan Smith, of course, wrote
indeed,
a novel.
Indeed.
Sorry, I didn't mean to scoff.
There's that, as did Anne Widdecombe. I believe Edwina Curry as well. They all do it, don't they? It's a desire for gravitas, isn't it? They want to be seen as proper people.
Is it that they believe their own hype? I mean, George Osborne apparently has got a book up his sleeve. I don't know.
There's clearly a connection, though, isn't there, in the faculties of the politician's and the writer's brain, or at least, you know, one way around, that politicians tend to think that they are also able to write books as well, which I think is just an interesting
correspondence. I like a classic political diary. Always interesting, easy structure. doesn't get too complicated. Stick with the diaries. That would be my verdict.
I like juicy details. You know, like the memoir of a former First Lady, Valérie Trevailer, talking about François Hollande. That was quite entertaining, I have to say.
Just before we go, Tom and Henry, your favourite political book?
Oh, I don't know. That's tricky, isn't it?
Be quick.
Tom, you go. Come on. History of the English-Speaking Peoples. That's the only Churchill book that comes to mind. I've not read it.
Is that a political book? I'll go for that.
Okay. I thought you were going to say that when you were talking diaries, I thought there was a plug for Alan Clark coming up there.
Oh, I mean, look, they are classic. I mean, what a fantastic book. Everyone would be well served to read that.
The Art of the Deal?
Perhaps not so
Shame
much.
Shame on you, Henry.
Anonymous Intimacy?
Or Anonymous Intimacy, obviously, which I'm sure we've just done wonders for its sales ranking on Amazon. Tom Edwards, Henry Rhys Sheridan, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you for joining us. The show was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando and Jimena Mignan. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. I'm back with The Daily at 2200. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.